Turn your mess into a message. Chris Wilkins joins us to talk about growing up as a tough guy, hiding abuse, checking out, and running away from the truth. He talks about connecting, getting honest and direct, and trying to help those without resources through programs like his, Heal the Hurt. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Illuminate Recovery Podcast. We shed light on mental health issues, mental illness, and addiction recovery. Ways to cope, manage, and inspire. Beyond the self-care we will discuss, you may need the help of a licensed professional. My name's Kurt Nider. I'm a husband, father, entrepreneur, a handyman, and a student of life. I avoid conflict, I deflect with humor, and I'm fascinated by the human experience.
And I'm Shelley Mangum. I am a clinical mental health counselor, and my favorite role of all times is grandma. I am a seeker of truth, and I feel like life should be approached with tremendous curiosity.
I ask the dumb questions.
I fill in the gaps.
The Illuminate Recovery Podcast is brought to you by Illuminate Billing Advocates. Make billing and collection simple with leader in substance abuse and mental health billing services. Verification and analysis of benefits, pre-authorizations, utilization management, accurate claim submission and management, denial and appeal management, and industry-leading reporting. Improve your practices, cash flow, and your ability to help your clients with Illuminate Billing Advocates.
Today, Kurt and I are excited to talk with Chris Wilkins. Chris is an LCSW. He is also the founder at Heal the Hurt in Provo, Utah. Heal the Hurt is a nonprofit providing scholarships to help people access treatment services that they can't afford but desperately need. He is also the director at Hobble Creek Behavioral Health. Chris, thanks so much for taking time out of your day to come and visit with us and share your experience.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. These are connections that I love and value very much. So thanks for taking time to let me get to know you guys.
So let's just start out letting our audience kind of get an idea of who you are, where you come from, and what your background is. So if maybe you could just give us kind of a history there, that'll give us a starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am originally from Arizona. I'm a Sun Devil. I'm in Utah now. And so with NBA playoffs going on, people keep asking me if I'm going to cheer Jazz or Suns. Love Arizona, love the desert, but came up to Utah when I was 12. Family moved up here, and so I've kind of been a back and forth transplant between here and the Phoenix Valley. When I was 11 and 13, experienced some abuse from a close friend, a family friend who lived outside of the home, but that was pretty shocking. That created a lot of distress for me. I'm the oldest of six in my family, and grew up with, I know a lot of people will say this, but I grew up with the best parents, the greatest scenario that I possibly could have imagined. Really blessed, really, really well taken care of. Two parents who literally sacrificed everything for us, for their children. And something in me at 11, I think probably equal parts fear and embarrassment and worry about being perceived as weak, convinced me to not say anything when I was abused. And in both of those scenarios, it was the same person. And in both of those scenarios, what would typically happen is I would wake up and something not okay was happening. And I was paralyzed, was frozen. I didn't know what to do, didn't know how to make myself safe. And I buried that. And at 14, when given the opportunity, so let me back up for a second, the family friend had this abuse first took place in Arizona, and then we moved to Utah, and the family friend had come to visit. And so 14, still new, still in a fairly new, at least it felt new, new state, new schools and those kinds of things. I hadn't really found my group yet, my friend group yet. A buddy of mine at school, kid who I thought was just really cool, popular, everybody liked him. Walking past him in the hallway, he kind of nudged me and said, "Hold out your hand." And so I did, and he dropped a couple of pills into my hand and said, "Take these." And it was under his breath. I knew exactly the situation. I didn't know what the pills were, but I knew what was going on. And I wanted his acceptance. I wanted to be cool. You know, at 14 in junior high, we are figuring ourselves out. We often might feel lost. We often might feel alone. And we want to fit in. We want to be cool. And so I took these pills, went and sat in a U.S. history class, and that felt incredible. That felt amazing. Not only emotionally and socially did I feel like I was winning, but physically, emotionally, physiologically, that was a high. That was something different. That felt really good. And that began my love for being intoxicated. That began my love for checking out, for numbing myself. And something that we talk about a lot in the recovery world, in therapy, is that every single action in this world is doing one of two things: either seeking pleasure and or avoiding pain. And so for me at 14 years old, those pills did both. I felt really good, and no longer was I thinking about the abuse. No longer was I thinking about fitting in. No longer was I worrying about any other stressor that was in my life at age 14. So that was kind of a miracle in my mind. This was this really cool thing. I began a secretive, kind of a hidden life. I learned how to hide that very well, whether it was pills, marijuana, alcohol. I learned how to get really sneaky with it and get away with it. Part of that lifestyle included theft, whether it was from individuals who left their belongings behind somewhere, maybe on the snowboard bus or the ski bus, or it was in shopping centers, stores, or malls. I became pretty savvy at that, and I actually got arrested when I was 16, stealing something from a store, and thought I was really clever, thought that I was really smart and really sneaky. And at 16, we rule the world, right? And my wording, I was trying to hide something. I wasn't given the full truth. And something with my wording or the way I said something led the officer to dig a little deeper. And it was a rough time. I had to go home and share with my parents what had happened. We had long talks, and throughout my life, I had many opportunities to I'll just kind of throw up some air quotes and confess. You know, I had many opportunities to say, "This is what's going on. This is why it's happening. I'm not okay. I need some help." I could never do that for those same reasons that I mentioned before. I never wanted to devastate my parents. These were, this person was a family friend. It would have devastated everybody. It would have wrecked those relationships in my mind. And so as a codependent martyr, I guess I decided to just fall on that sword and deal with it and keep everybody else from hurting. And my technique, my method for that was continuing to drink, continuing to check out. I discovered along the way, I discovered girls. I discovered deceit, being deceptive, adrenaline. I very much enjoyed getting away with things and being really sneaky. And so that led to a lot of chaos and contention and struggle and pain that impacted. I played some sports in high school, and that impacted my effort there. That impacted my performance there. It impacted relationships with coaches. And I think in some ways I came off as having an attitude when in all reality, there was a lot of the other stuff under the surface that I hid. So fast forward to, I don't know, after a while, changing my ways or not having a supplier or wanting to change, wanting to commit to be better or whatever, would have some periods of doing really well and not really acting out, not struggling with the substance or behavior, and ended up getting married, had a child, and life was good. And I found myself back in the thick of checking out and numbing out. And that created a lot of tension, jeopardized the marriage. Ended up that she had some addiction issues too that resurfaced. And so here we have this child born to two addicts, born to two people with struggle, two people with trauma, significant trauma. And we ended up divorcing and co-parenting. And so, that became a something of a maybe opportunity to learn how to live outside of myself better. Being a father is the most important thing in my world, in my life. And it's been ever since she was born. And sometimes that comes at the expense of other important things in my life. But I guess once you become a parent, or at least for me, once I became a parent, it was like the world changed. When that happened, there was a desire to live differently, more motivation to be well, to be healthy. A couple of years prior to her being born, this person I'd married before had said, "What happened? Something, we were talking one night, something happened to you." And I said, "No, nothing. Everything's good." And she persisted, really, really perceptive that way. And she persisted and said, "No, you tell me, you can tell me what happened." And so I proceeded to tell her what happened when I was 11 and 13. And she said,
"Is this the first time you've told another person?"
First time I'd ever told anybody. Yeah. Yeah. See, I jumped around a bit. First time I told anybody. And she said, in fact, we were in my parents' driveway. And she said, "We got to go inside. We got to tell them." And I said, no, we don't. They don't need to know. I'm over it. I've forgiven. I've moved on. It doesn't affect me anymore." And she's like, that's crap. Let's go. And sure enough, went in there and just kind of bore my soul. I can imagine that my parents were devastated and shocked. And maybe because of my relationship with my parents today, thinking back, I can only imagine a sense of relief that they must have felt for understanding why. Why from that early age was there this struggle? Why were all those things happening? Why was my personality the way that it was? Why did I choose the things that I did? I can only imagine now that there was a little ounce of that relief because now they got it. Now they understood. It didn't erase the past. It didn't take away that pain. But maybe being able to know why, or that there was a reason, there was a cause, maybe brought some relief. There was an, I'm going to jump to the future for a second. On this timeline, there was a moment later on in life where I'd relapsed. I'd gone back into living a way that wasn't too proud of, and got into some trouble, and had to reconcile that and get some treatment of my own and everything. And a couple of years after that, there was a celebration. Things were good. I'll say it that way, kind of vaguely. Things were going really well, and my mom and dad got to attend a little ceremony for me. And I remember my mother hugging me and whispering in my ear, "I'm so proud of you. I wish that back then, amidst all that struggle, I could have seen forward to today. And that's really powerful for me and for our family, because in the midst of struggle, I think we are paralyzed so often. I think we get stuck in that sorrow. I think so often we get stuck in the pain rather than considering that maybe this is temporary. Maybe, you know, that phrase, this too shall pass. Maybe on some level, this will all make sense someday. And we'll be able to look back and have some understanding. So anyway, a couple of times in my life, I'll go back. A couple of times in my life, I've done really well, kind of get complacent, kind of think, oh, I got this. Everything's good. I'm on fire. And ego comes in, or maybe not feeling like I need to continue doing my own work. And sure enough, that those demons creep back in. Those struggles, they rear their ugly heads. And so that happened a couple of times in my life. That has happened a couple of times in my life. And so in my practice now, one of the things that's incredibly important has become a regular for my people is this idea of do your dailies, that it doesn't matter to me how much time somebody has sober. I'm more concerned with where their heart is. I'm more concerned with what their recovery looks like. And a lot of times people will use recovery and sobriety synonymously, and that it means the same thing. And there are some people in the rooms or people who participate in, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous or any other anonymous or trauma recovery healing, where the idea of sobriety more has to do with, can you provide a clean urine sample? Do you have drugs in your system right now? Is your sobriety? Whereas recovery has more to do with the way we see ourselves, the way we see others, our humility, our level of love and compassion and service to others. So to me, I really care about recovery. And that doesn't justify if we continue to do the things that led us to destruction. You know, I can't do so much good and justify the bad. That doesn't work that way. But for so long, I personally banked my value on how many days I went without a drink, or how many days I went without a pill, how many days I went without air duster, how many days I went without the use of gambling or pornography or women or some shopping. Retail therapy became a real struggle, especially as an adult. That was a coping mechanism that I thought, well, it's not a drug, it's not a chemical, I'm not hurting anybody. But I'd spend an entire paycheck on stuff I didn't need, or clothing, or baseball games. When my lifestyle was not such, when my budget was not such that was okay. So the idea of not living our values, not living our priorities, that's something that we focus a lot on as well, what our individual values are. And if we're in recovery, that doesn't mean we're perfect. It doesn't mean we never mess up, we never struggle, but it means that either once I recognize that there's a struggle, or somebody else grabs me and says, Chris, what are you doing? This isn't you. This isn't what you teach. And there's a level of humility and acceptance. I could go, oh, wow, I didn't even see it. I didn't even notice that happening. Like, thanks so much for raising my awareness. Thanks for saying something about it. Because I think as humans, sometimes we see people backing up toward a cliff and they don't know it. They don't see that it's there. And we just kind of, we don't want to hurt them and offend them. We don't want them to get mad at us. And so we just watch them do it. We watch them teeter and eventually fall off that cliff. And if they live, if they survive it, they might ask the question, like, why didn't you say anything? Like, why didn't you help me? Why didn't you save me from myself? You know, there was this treacherous thing in my path and you didn't do anything about it. And so now as a human and as a therapist and any other role that I play, I'm like probably yelling louder than I need to. Like, hey, there's a cliff over there. What are you doing? because I there was a long part of my life where I was the bystander. I would just look on as somebody would fall into that kind of a struggle, and I'd rather not risk that by inaction anymore.
Well, Chris, you bring up, I want to just jump in there, is because I'm hearing this theme, right? As you talked about your, you know, being abused and waking up in the middle of the night, being abused and being frozen. There's a lot of people that can't put words to what happened. You know, I've talked to people who have said, this happened to me, this trauma happened to me. And it's like they can't make sense of it. And when you give them the words, like you just did, of, I was frozen, I couldn't move, I didn't know what to do with this, that it starts to make sense of, oh, they didn't give me a choice, right? Because we so often, the only thing we can control is us. So if it's our fault, if we made the problem and the error, then we can do something about it. And so we own it, right? Just like you did. You have to own it. You have to carry this heavy load, because if you don't, it's going to mess up your family and it's going to mess up relationships. And you know, and I'm sure that at that young age, you also had lots of thoughts about, I'm messed up. This must happen to me because I'm messed up and, you know, something's wrong with me. And so I don't want anybody to see that. So I can't talk about it.
Exactly. Especially in a culture that, or a community that I was raised in that, you know, if we mess up, there's badness to that. And I think Brené Brown talks about it the best, in my opinion, the difference between guilt and shame. Guilt is good. It tells us we have a conscience. We're not sociopaths. You know, we recognize we messed up. Whereas the shame is, we are messed up. We are bad, and that it's our existence. And a lot of our work is around that, recognizing that we make mistakes. We're human. Mm-hmm. And there is no shame in our humanness. There is no shame in the mistake. But the invitation is, with love and with compassion, let's do something about it. How can we halt the cycle? How can we get out of this loop of destruction? And that's something I've had to apply in my own life and come up with kind of my protocol for what keeps me safe, what keeps me healthy, what keeps me moving in the right direction. And I try to give that or encourage my clients or my people to do something similar. Not my style, not my exact dailies, but what is theirs? What's realistic for them according to their schedule, their interests, their level of rebelliousness or resistance to things? Because it's hard work and it's uncomfortable. But if there's a willingness, then I very much believe we can break so many bad habits. We can overcome so many traumas and problems and distresses that people can truly be happy and feel joy. So, yeah, I look at the analogy of like the princess and the pea, maybe. And we all have a tiny little pea that's down there, and we can throw as many mattresses on top. And I'm totally distorting the story. But we can throw as many mattresses between ourselves and the pea, but we're still going to feel it. It's still going to be felt until we rip off all of those layers and get to it and figure out what it is and deal with it properly, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's so powerful to normalize it. Freezing in that kind of a situation is a normal human response, right? It's a normal human response, but we somehow think we're flawed because we didn't do anything or say anything, but we don't realize we couldn't, right? You couldn't, people can't. In those situations, sometimes they can't. And recognizing that's a human experience allows them to maybe take a breath and go, oh, all this shame that I put on myself isn't real. Like I didn't have the power to do anything about that anyway. So I love the way you talk about that, because I think it is super freeing for people.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to recognize and not wallow in it. Let's not just like commiserate and be weak in always being in pain, but there's a lot of gray area or a lot of middle ground between I'm perfect or I'm awful. You know, there's so much middle ground there. And I think we probably, I don't know the term for it, but we just probably go back and forth on some level of some days, wow, I feel really good. I'm loving it. You know, life is great. And, you know, I might stub my toe every now and again, but overall things are awesome. And then there are probably moments where we're like, why? me? Like, what did I do? Why do I feel like I can never catch a break? And we need to normalize that, or naturalize that. I like to
put some humanize.
Yes, I love it. You know, so I kind of think of normal as reasonably healthy, whereas natural or human, it's like a typical thing. Hey, this comes up, this happens. We don't want to consider it normal and healthy and forever, but let's acknowledge that this is a thing. And then I think we're better prepared to do something, better prepared and equipped to do something about it. So.
Yeah, I agree. And one other comment that you made too, is that as a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old, if you were to tell your parents, who you fully acknowledge were amazing, wonderful parents that were open, you could have conversations with them. Had you told them, there were some huge consequences that you didn't have the maturity to navigate that, right? That was more than you could manage, to think that this is going to ruin lives. And, you know, maybe this person's going to go to jail or whatever it is, you're holding on to that. What would you tell somebody today from the perspective that you're at today that's in that situation?
The perspective today is, I say this, you're not alone. You're not bad. You're not broken. You're not weak. These things unfortunately happen. And I have a belief that anybody who does those things has had something of that nature done to them. We don't create these ideas on our own. We have to learn them somewhere. And so even as a young person, I kind of felt a sense of compassion, knowing this person a little bit, like their circumstances, and having the idea that they must have been through worse than what they put me through. And for a long time, I felt weak in that. But now today I have acceptance, and I understand that I hesitate to say this for other people, but this is part of my healing. That happened for a purpose. I needed to understand. I don't say this to others. I don't tell them how to feel or how to reconcile their own pain, their own suffering. But for me, this is part of my healing process, because I work with a great number of individuals who've been abused physically, psychologically, sexually. And I believe that I needed to have some experiences. I wish I could have gotten that experience some other way. I wish I didn't have to go through that. But somebody a long time ago said the phrase, turn your mess into a message. And I also like the phrase, turn your pain into a purpose, or from your pain, create purpose. And I think I wouldn't have gotten it. I think I wouldn't have had the compassion or the understanding or the ability to connect with somebody else had I not gone through those things. I just wouldn't have noticed it. And so by no means would I say, like, if I could do it all over again, would I want to go through that again? Absolutely not. No. But because I'm so passionate about the work that we do, I have to attribute it to that, to having been in a sense of hell, a state of hell, a state of powerlessness. Because so many of our people, adults and kids, are experiencing or have experienced those same things. And so the statements of you're not alone, there are others. It's okay to tell. It's okay. It's okay to talk about it. This person or these people or these things happening aren't okay, and they need help. And if we can get them the help, then maybe they have a chance at stopping that, at ending the cycle, at not hurting anyone else. If we don't do anything about it, that cycle usually continues. That cycle usually worsens, unfortunately. And so if we have an opportunity to get somebody the help, even though it's scary and it's humiliating, devastating, it wrecks families, we need to shift our culture to be okay with those levels of devastation that might be more public, in our effort to getting away from the private devastation that festers and grows and snowballs. Because I think we are allowing, this is a maybe strong blanket statement, but through the taboo-ness of the topics of abuse and neglect and harm, because we're not comfortable with those things, we go ostrich style. We stick our head in the sand, we pretend like it doesn't exist, while all the while it's happening everywhere. The statistics are overwhelming. They are devastating. I have 4 kids. It becomes completely different in my mind and in my heart when I go from thinking about myself dealing with pain, being a victim, being hurt, and then when I start to think about if this were to happen to my child. And I can't fathom that. I can't stomach that. And I won't. And so we have to talk about it. We have to address it. I've worked a lot of my career in residential treatment. And we just call them treatment centers. And there's a treatment perspective. There's kind of a treatment track or a modality of treating things after the fact. And then there's this topic of prevention. And so 2 or 3 days, maybe a week into people's treatment, I would say to them, this isn't a treatment center for you anymore. This is a prevention center. We've got to figure out how to keep this from happening again so that you don't have to come back. And that concept, I think as a society, if we can start to fathom that, if we can start to look at it from that perspective, let's go prevent rather than wait until it's bad enough that somebody needs help. I mean, imagine the lives that we will change. Imagine the harmony that can exist in our families, that can exist in our schools, that can exist in, I mean, every area of our society, if we would prevent it.
And it's like you're talking about, Chris, which is so incredible, is that, you know, this abuse and these experiences thrive on someone being in silence, right? Suffering in silence. And what you're, you know, suggesting is that we can do this as a community. And instead of looking at that person who did that act that was hurtful, you know, whether it's a sexual abuse or any kind of abuse, who did that act, to see them as a human being, like you've talked about, and to see them with a problem. They're not engaging in that behavior because they're a healthy human being. They're engaging in that behavior because they have wounds too, and they need help. And if we can stop, you know, coming at it from a punitive point of view, which our society has done for a long, long time, and there's a lot of forces working, you know, working to improve that, but there's a lot of work to be done in that area. But if it can be, we love you, we care about you, hey, there's some things we can do that will help you and will help everyone else too, then it doesn't become so shaming, right? And so hard, it becomes, you know, there's going to be some consequences, but that's going to be okay too, right? The consequences are going to be okay. We're going to do it together. So I love that approach. And I love the way you're talking about that, because it's exactly where we need to go, one person at a time. You know, it feels painful going one person at a time.
Yeah, it does. But you know, I saw something the other day. It was 2 ladders side by side. I think I saw it on Instagram. I reshared it. It was 2 ladders side by side. And one of the ladders had, like, I don't know, 20 rungs on the ladder. And it had somebody going up it. And the one on the right had, like, maybe 4 rungs. And the idea was that baby steps are more productive. And that one on the right, the feeling I got was kind of like addict mentality in a way, that we don't get that big of a, whoa, that's amazing, from the baby step. Like, I want it swift, fast, intense more, right? And I started thinking about it in terms of now as a business owner, as an employer, as a father of four, not just one, right? Like it's there's more to it. And I have to remind myself that it's all about those baby steps, those incremental, where are we going? Where are we heading? And that's got to encompass every part of my life, the recovery process, my own behavioral health. If I'm there sitting in space with another human and connecting with them and creating sharing that space for them and their healing and trying to be a catalyst, if I'm not on point with my own stuff, how am I going to be a father? How am I going to be a husband? How am I going to be a beneficial therapist? And, you know, I think if we could take off or if we could discard the expectation of being perfect, I think a lot of change would happen. I really do. And that's a whole other topic and conversation and probably a rabbit hole, but I think we have a lot of us that are out there putting on a facade when inside things aren't okay. And we just don't feel that. Dr. Gabor Mate said it. He probably didn't invent this quote, but he says it the most eloquently and concisely for me. And it resonates in my mind. He says in one of his talks, only when a person senses some compassion will they allow themselves to see the truth. We have a movement in our society, the My Truth movement. And I used to love it because it was so validating for everybody in their own perspectives. And then I felt like we started to miss the point. We started to treat everybody's perspective, even disagreeing perspectives, as truth. And we wouldn't get into discussion or conversation or connection. But this idea that if I don't feel compassion, I won't allow myself to see reality. That's so profound to me. And I see that working in my own life, and I see that working in my career, in my work with my people. That if I'm disconnected, if I'm distracted, we're not going very far. And I owe it to my people to show that, to be present, to be compassionate. But again, that puts a lot of pressure on us as individuals to take care of ourselves. You know.
Well, it does. And what you just said is that we're human and we're imperfect and we're not always going to show up at our best and 100% because we can't. I mean, there's just days where, you know, something's overwhelming. If you, one of your kids, and I can tell that you love them with every part of your body, right? Every part of your soul, you love those kids. You're going to protect them with your life if you have to. If something's going on with your kids, it's really tough to show up and be 100% present, right? For an example. And so you have to allow that, you know, that give and take of, you know, and acknowledge today I am not 100% right here because I got something I'm worried about or whatever it is, and allow that imperfection, right? To talk about it and speak it out, but that the goal is I'm going to take care of this thing so that it doesn't keep, you know, coming up and showing up in my space when I'm trying to do something else. But I love the ideas and the change, right? And the way you question things, you're questioning like the truth movement. What's my truth, right? And the thing I love more than anything is going after truth. But truth comes from getting everybody else's perspectives and having that discussion of, well, what does that look like for you? And if it looks like that for you, does it have to look like that for me? You know, and talking about that. And so you can meet in the middle, that just because this is the way you feel doesn't mean it's the way I have to feel. And so I love the way you question everything because I think it's important. Vital, right? It's vital.
I don't know that my parent, when I was younger, I don't know that my parents loved that questioning. And I joke, I'm so pro agency. I'm so pro you get to make your own choices as long as you're not hurting somebody else. Like, all the way from the trivial Pepsi or Coke to the more intense things about our values and human rights and things that way. You know, again, provided we're not hurting somebody or we're not being unsafe, I very much support, like, do your thing. And I joke that I want people to question, I want people to wonder, I want them to ask the whys until I'm around my kids and they start to go, yeah, but why? Or no, they start to resist or rebel. And I go, I want everyone else to have this agency, but not you. Just because it makes it difficult as a parent, right? I think that maybe hits home for all of us with kids. But we can't, our principles can't be part-time. We've got to always practice the principles. And the truth is that we're not always going to be perfect with them. But if we can just use that terminology that we're always practicing our principles, right? Because there are those moments where I forget, you know? And I think I have a pretty good memory. I really do. That's one reason today that I'm like, I can't get high. I can't get drunk. I can't do any of these things because my cognition, my memory, my thought process, like that's my career. And it's also my survival in so many ways. So maybe now part of my sobriety is fear. healthy fear, we'll call it that. But I think there's a lot of information, and that's another rabbit hole, another conversation. But the idea of we're all works in progress. Our humanness is there and we need to accept it. We need to acknowledge that it's there and not mail it in like, well, sorry, I'm a human. Sorry that I hurt you again today. Sorry that I messed up again today. It's just who I am. You have to accept it. That's not what we're saying. That doesn't work. That's not a desire to change or improve. It's, you know, I've been really trying hard and here are the areas that I've improved. And today I struggled or yesterday I messed up, I fell off or, you know, I'm so sorry. And this is what I'm learning from it. I think when we can take accountability, but also acknowledge our imperfection, man, we've got a real, real nice recipe for success in my opinion.
Right. Well, yeah. And you talked about that idea. I love this. What you said was, you know, all of the good in the world, you know, going around and doing good, 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 and making a difference here and serving this person here and you know, showing up for your family does not justify the bad behaviors that you're engaging in, right? You can do all of that good and try and go, well, I do all this good, so it must be okay. It doesn't justify it. It doesn't make that okay, right? And that's a lack of integrity in your system, and your system knows it, right? It's incongruent inside your body. And so it creates this chaos inside. And so it's not okay. But I can't tell you how many people I've talked to and they're like, you see that pattern, right? You see this shadow over here that's just causing them all this grief. And yet they do so much good, right? So much incredible things that they can do. So I want to ask you a question. I think this is an imperative question. You talked about your kids. And I think so many people are worried about our kids because the research says that, you know, 1 in 3 are going to be abused in one way or another, and maybe sexually abused for women and men. Maybe it's a little less, maybe it's not. I don't know. That's questionable. But, you know, that's worrisome to me as a mom and to you as, you know, to us as parents. And what is that conversation that you have with your kids that changes the dynamic that you experienced as a child?
That it's okay to talk about feeling unsafe. I think there was a generation where, again, just the taboo things, those topics, it was like, well, we just don't talk about it. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen until this point. You know, sex doesn't happen until you're married. We don't hurt each other. We don't punch each other. And it was just like an all or nothing. Just don't do it. And I think our generation now, I think our society now is more open to talking about it. I'd like to think that. Maybe I'm wrong. I think there are more avenues to talking about it if we're willing. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of people who are in distress because they don't know how to talk about it with their kids. but some of the conversations that we have with our little ones are let's use the issue of sexual abuse. You know, nobody's allowed to look at you there. Nobody's allowed to touch you there. That doesn't work. Even if it's mom or dad, you go tell the other parent, because some of these stories that we hear, these devastations that we hear, it's a trusted loved one that does it. And so it's so confusing that, you know, only mom or dad can wash you or touch you there or something like that, or the doctor, you know, in an exam. But then it's confusing because there's healthy touch and then there's unhealthy touch. And if I think about a child brain, our ability to understand and really comprehend, we've taught them all or nothing. It's either no touch or yes, it's okay. We need to look deeper than that. We need to clarify. And there are actually a few books that are really good, I think, that talk about this, children's books. For the longest time, I've wanted to start writing children's books that talk about some of these topics and how to talk about them. In fact, right behind me on my bookshelf, there's a book called The Elephant in the Room. And as an adult, I'm in my 30s, and as an adult, I still prefer picture books. And there's a lot of great content out there, a lot of great stuff that I like to read. I actually like audiobooks better because then I can mow the lawn and listen or something like that. My brain, the way that it is structured, or the way I've conditioned it, or both, I need the illustration. I love analogies. I love parables. And for somebody to tell me a story while they're teaching me something, because then I'll comprehend it, I'll stay focused on it, and I'll remember it. So I've become that way as well in my work, in my own teaching. But to help our kids understand that their feelings matter, that even if as an adult I might be like, well, why are you crying? Like, what are you crying for? What's wrong? What, you know, this isn't, what's that phrase? This isn't something to cry about. Well, that comes out of my mouth. I don't like the term, I don't like the phrase shame on me, but if that comes out of my mouth, shame on me. Why am I doing that? I don't believe that.
It's just a figure of speech.
Exactly, you know? And so if we can show up for our kids and help them truly feel safe in all areas, they're more likely to tell us if and when something bad happens, something unsafe happens. There's a natural exploration. There's a natural curiosity around sexuality. And I think it's important for us to teach our kids the difference between those things. Not that we endorse the curiosity and show and tell kinds of stuff, but that we understand that there is a difference between those things. There is a maliciousness to an adult or an older child or older teenager or something like that, hurting someone who's younger. Grooming is something that we talk about. Not the two youngest, they're not ready to comprehend that, but the two oldest can comprehend that. Mm-hmm. Being able to, us as parents, have a ooh, this might offend some people. It's important for us to have a maturity level that we can have those we can strike up and have those conversations with our kids or our grandkids, our nieces and nephews, the students. You know, I've got a sister who's a teacher and another sister who's studying to become a teacher. And there are, in my own observation, there are some parents who seem to believe that the public school system is responsible for raising their children. And that breaks my heart. I can certainly understand the convenience of that, but it breaks my heart for those kids. It also breaks my heart for the parents, because I do believe that somewhere down the road there will be some regret. But I think we have a responsibility, no matter what hat we wear, to support our children. These are our future leaders. I know the cliches, the future leaders of our world, our future presidents, our future, you know, our future doctors and all of those things, but I don't take that those roles and responsibilities lightly. It's really important for us to take time for our kids to matter, for them to know that they matter. And then if they're concerned about something, if they wonder about something, that it's okay to ask, that we aren't going to get mad at them, that if, heaven forbid, something bad happens, an abuse, bullying, if something happens, that it's not their fault, that they don't need to protect us in our hearts, that they don't need to hold that secret in. You mentioned a second ago, Shelley, like our body feels it when it's incongruent, you know, and that could be, you're kind of referencing our own actions and our own value system, but even those secrets, we're holding it in, and it's a foreign object. It's a toxin. And so as we hold it in, it's doing damage. It's destroying the body. It's destroying the soul. It's causing a lot of harm and havoc. And so we've got to learn how to safely and appropriately and maybe even diplomatically, like, get those things out. There are a lot of humans that I interact with. I'm thinking of how to say this. Who, like when I was 20 or 21, and she said to me, "What happened? Something happened. What was it?" We probably all know people in our world who are just like I was, holding it in, pretending like everything was okay. One of my hopes is, or maybe even a challenge, is that we get to a point where we can be that person to someone else that says, "You can tell me, I'm safe, won't judge you, I won't reel back and be shocked, but you're safe to tell me and you matter." Old or young, you know, no matter who these individuals are, but that we can show up that way for somebody. So.
Yeah, you come from a compassionate stance kind of in all of these circumstances, right? I mean, I think, like you're saying, as a parent, that's sometimes harder to do because it's stressful, but it's one of the most obvious places. You know, with a child, we should certainly be compassionate. I think one of the things that's interesting to see as kind of emotional intelligence grows in the world, that's becoming more acceptable and more demanded as like an employer, right? If you have an employee who's not performing, the metrics aren't there, you really need to start with the, hey, what happened? You know, what's going on? What's the personal story or whatever? And it's powerful, I think, to go back, you know, even as an individual who's abused, that you were inclined to feel that way about your abuser, right? And you felt like it was a weakness, but it's not a weakness. Like the power in the assumption for you as a child that your abuser had been abused, right? Like that, to me, I think that's such a powerful thing to think that, you know, an 11 or a 12-year-old had thought. And obviously that's turned into other things, you know, tell us about Heal the Hurt. What's the background with Heal the Hurt and how does it work?
I have worked in the prison system. I've worked for county-funded programs. I've worked in the exclusive treatment centers where where people who are very well off go. I've seen individuals with absolutely nothing and maybe less than nothing, if that's possible, who needed help. And I've seen individuals with millions and millions of dollars who needed help. And being able to do work in both of those extremes as far as socioeconomic status and privilege or poverty, I've noticed some differences, a few differences, but more than anything, so many similarities. There were so many times where somebody had no resources, but needed help and was willing. And in both of these, the main treatment centers that I spent the majority of my career working in, a lot of scholarships were offered or funds were available. And something that was a prerequisite was to the potential client, to the person who needed help, was, what's your story? What's going on? What can you do? What are your resources? And let us make up the difference. So it wasn't a freebie. It wasn't a free ride. It wasn't a handout. It was, what are you willing to do? What do you need? What's the cost associated with this, whether it was a financial or some other thing, some other barrier? And how can we remove those barriers? So often I'm a social worker. When I went to grad school, I was trying to be a psychologist. I wanted to get a PhD in psychology, and I applied for 2 years and didn't get into any of the schools. And Arizona State had accepted me to their MSW program, and I turned it down. I don't think I told them that. Well, I turned it down. I don't think I told them why. And a year later, there were some personal things that were going on. And a year later, I called them up, and after not getting in again to the psychology programs, I said, you accepted me a year ago. Could I still come? And they said, yeah. And that's why I became a social worker. And one of the reasons I didn't want to do that, because I had this idea that they just handed out food stamps for some strange reason. I don't know why that was my bias or my stigma. Because if I were given the option to go back and be a psychologist, I wouldn't do it. I love the study of the brain, but I couldn't do, and if a psychologist ever listens to this, they'll probably comment like, that's not what we do. We don't do that all day. But I couldn't do testing. I don't like testing. I love to converse. I love to meet the person. I'm way too social of a person to do, to have like a lot of clients that I only meet one or two times. I like to see people at the beginning and then see them when they fire me, when they say, I don't need to come here anymore. Thanks for what you did. And I'm going to take it from here. I love that. That's a huge, warm feeling for me. But so many times that bleeding heart, some people call this codependency, right? And some people call it compassion. But I would see where people needed help and they just didn't have the resources. And nobody becomes a social worker or therapist to make millions and billions of dollars. It's just not, you don't choose this for the money. And I have a brother and my dad are both in finance and accounting and they work in money. And so when I have those kinds of questions, I ask them, hey, what should I do? They're the experts on that. I might've made more in my career doing that, but I don't think I'd be happy. I want people to get the resources that they need. And so we opened this foundation. It's a nonprofit. We're pursuing 501c3 status so that we can have those kinds of benefits to it for our donors. But literally 100% of anything that comes through to Heal the Hurt nonprofit goes to scholarships. Nobody's paid. There are no salaried employees. Everybody's a volunteer. When we don't have scholarship funds, we just do it. We just write it off. We just tell the person, like, we're going to give you the service and essentially it's kind of the honor system, like, do well with it. Don't take advantage of it. When we do have funds available right now, we just started a campaign. There's a person who's worked in the recovery field for quite some time who was in recovery and has lost it. Is really struggling and is back in the throes of addiction. And they have incredibly limited resources, and the resources that they do have are kind of disqualifiers for most treatment centers here. There are a lot of treatment centers, and I might offend somebody too. There's a lot of treatment centers out there. I'm really picky. I know what good treatment is. There's a greater importance in my mind to figure out how to put somebody through the right treatment center for their personality, for their story, for the emotions that they're dealing with, than finding the cheapest one. But we have a We have relationships with a few treatment centers here locally and some other parts of the country that are willing to do some scholarships as well. And so it's kind of a mutual partnership where if we're able to raise the funds for this particular person to get back into residential treatment, the treatment center is willing to reduce their cost, reduce the expense for them to go through. So that's our mission. Somebody that needs help but can't do it, we want to do it. We want to be able to provide for them. Somebody said to me a long time ago, there's a difference between I need it, but I can't get it, and I need it, but I won't. And so we're we have conversations about the circumstances. We require our scholarship recipients to write out their story, talk to us a little bit about their circumstances, why, kind of like, I guess it's an application process, that we know those funds are going to go to a good candidate, somebody that's serious about their recovery. I was writing a little paragraph yesterday, and I was thinking about, I wish our recipients could, I wish we could share their stories, because I am so privileged to be able to see that change and how other people's charity benefits people who are struggling and suffering. But because of HIPAA laws and confidentiality, it's like our hands are tied. And so it's, sometimes I feel badly saying, give us this money because we want to help people, but then I can't show you the product. I can't show you what we're doing with it. It feels icky, actually. But I think individuals who've been there, I think individuals who've seen somebody struggle and suffer and not be able to get the treatment, get it. But we want, heal the hurt. The goal is to be something like, not in grandeur, but something like a Red Cross or Wounded Warrior or something. I probably shouldn't say names of other organizations, but an organization that just has the ability to give people the treatment that they need. And someday our vision is that the clinical work will be in-house, that Heal the Hurt will grow and be able to employ people to provide the treatment. And it would be more of a situation of people coming into our program, not just us sending people out and being kind of the financial liaison, I guess, but that we'd be able to provide that work. And that's something that we, with Hobble Creek, that we're growing, we're creating and building and trying to be able to provide a variety of services to a variety of populations. But that's somewhere down the road to be able to do those services in-house. And so essentially everything that comes in, every donation, and we sell, like we'll sell some t-shirts or we'll put, you know, some memorabilia. We've done some giveaways where I just through our private practice did like a March Madness tournament bracket challenge. And so I just donated $100 and just asked people, like, if you'll buy in for $1, the winner gets $100 of mine. And so it doesn't come from the donation fund. It doesn't come from any of that stuff. It's just something that we want to generate some excitement for. I also think, like, just talking about it makes us feel good. It helps us to feel compassion for other people. I really don't know the last time that I traveled a reasonable distance without seeing somebody on the side of the road asking for help. And by reasonable distance, I mean like 10 or more miles. I'm really blessed to have a 4 mile commute between home and my office right now. So anytime I'm traveling somewhere other than between work and home, I'm seeing somebody struggling. And I can't even imagine the number of people who struggle in silence. So we want to reach out to those people. So the other part is, as I talk about this, is simultaneously, do we ask people to consider us when they think about donating, when they think about, okay, we've got X number of of, you know, things for charity, X number of funds or whatever, to consider us, but also those who might listen to this, are you struggling? Do you have a loved one who needs help? Please reach out to me. We're not just taking and taking and taking. We do some of these conversations and have some of these chats because we want to raise awareness that there are resources available. Because so often that's one of those big barriers that just communicates in the mind, like, oh, I can't even do it because I don't have insurance, or I can't do it because I've already asked my parents for money, or I've already asked my clergy, or, you know, that's just an egregious amount of money. Just can't do it. Well, let's figure it out. Let's get creative. And let me give an example. My parents for money, or I've already asked my clergy, or, you know, that's just an egregious amount of money. Just can't do it. Well, let's figure it out. Let's get creative. And let me give an example. Right now we're trying to raise $10,000 to put this person through a quality residential treatment. And let's say we come up with $2,000. Maybe clergy can come up with $2,000. Maybe family could come up with another $2,000. And before we know it, we're really, really close to that goal. It doesn't have to be this lofty, here's the amount and here's where we've got to get it. Part of a social worker's responsibility is bringing those resources together and getting really creative. And part of my own healing has been learning how to give myself some of those highs in a natural way. And I get one of those from seeing somebody go from that hellish sorrow and despair to having a new lease on life, so to speak, or being able to get creative when there's a little dilemma, like we're X number of dollars short, where is it going to come from? Rather than giving up and throwing our hands in the air saying, let's talk about it. Let's figure this out. What can we do? So yeah, the mission is just to get people the care that they need, whether they can afford it or not. The quality care.
Yeah. Chris, I'm imagining, I mean, you've done just a great segue into, you know, how does somebody give? How do they connect with you? How do they connect with Heal the Heart? Talk about that for a second so that they know how to connect with you.
We have a really generic website right now. It's healtheheart.org. We, on that, there's a, let me qualify this for a second. I see a lot of, without saying the names of these other things, where you can go donate to a cause, but they take 10% or they take 20%. Some of the organizations that maybe the donation goes to fund their building, or it goes to fund their overhead or their salaries of their CEOs. And my cynicism starting to come out here for a second. I apologize. So we opened a Venmo, and Venmo doesn't charge anything for those donations. It doesn't skim anything off the top. And so I felt really good about that somebody's donation went completely, entirely to this cause. On our website now, I think it gave us the opportunity to open to do a PayPal as well. So on our website, you can find our Venmo, you can find our PayPal. We also invite people. We do have some single parents. We do have some individuals who get evicted from their home residence. And then they find new housing and they need things like couches or maybe clothing, especially winter coats and things like that. We don't want to turn into Deseret Industries or Savers or something like that. But there are those moments where somebody says, hey, I've got this. I was going to run it down to the thrift store to donate it. You know, do you have anybody that could use it? And sometimes we say no. And sometimes we go, you know what, that's actually just visited with somebody who needs exactly that. Let's figure this out. We want to just connect people with the resources that they need. But I've even said to people, you know, maybe, you know, if you've got a couple of bucks, that's great. If you don't, but you know somebody who does, could you share the message? You know, just spread the word at what we're trying to do. In the future, we will be doing this more consistently. COVID kind of wrecked a lot of stuff for us, didn't it?
Oh, my heavens, yes.
But we've been starting to plan some workshops some psychoeducation type things, some groups on the topics of relationship issues and communication, trauma support groups, teen and child themed things, parent issues that fathers deal with, issues that mothers deal with, step parents or blended family dynamics. And so we've got a curriculum that's in a rough draft form where we'll be providing these in the community. And those, a lot of those will be free, but with a kind of an optional donation for somebody to come attend. But these are some of those things where we feel like as clinicians or as people who've maybe been there, I feel a great responsibility to share that with the community. Again, whether you can pay for it or not, if you can and you can donate, then that's great. That's amazing. But we want to create a normalcy of going and getting, accessing those resources, acknowledging like, I need some help. I need some support. We're going to go to this group. We're going to go learn. Hey kids, you know, you're on your, you know, here's a pizza for tonight. Mom and I are going to learn how to be better parents for you. And the kids are just going, my parents aren't perfect. Like they're still learning. Like talk about getting your mind blown that your parents like aren't know-it-alls. Right. And I think just setting that trend of we're still learning, we're still figuring it out. I've been doing this work for a long time and some people, I'm a supervisor and I'm an employer and I'm a director and those things. I'm a patient too. I'm still figuring it out. Mm-hmm. I'm still learning. I don't think we understand what the word expert means. I think we put that term on a pedestal. I think we just expect that it's perfect, that it's all knowing, and it just isn't a real thing. So something else that we're trying to do are some retreats and some experiences where somebody may not be able to go to residential treatment. Maybe they don't meet the criteria for residential treatment, but they need something more than group therapy or individual therapy. And so we're in the process of planning some retreats, some getaways where just a couple of days, where again, it's themed, maybe a men's group, and we get away and kind of talk about men's things. We've got some individuals on our team that will be leading the female-only segments and retreats and focusing on those things. And one of the barriers that comes from that is, well, what do I do with my kids? Or I can't leave my family. I can't leave my work. Is us figuring out how to make it reasonable for somebody to get away for 2 or 3 days to work on themselves, to better themselves, so that they can then return to whatever those endeavors are and be more efficient and effective in those roles. So to just go back, yeah, our website, healthehurt.org, we're on Instagram, we're revamping our Facebook, but I think our best bet is for people to just jump on our website, again, healthehurt.org. So
that's incredible. Cool. Incredible work that you're doing, Chris. I just applaud that. And matter of fact, I might have to connect with you and see how I can be a part of that, because it sounds like the exact movement we're talking about. There needs to be change. So thanks so much for being willing to share that and share what you're doing, your vision of that, where it's going. And definitely there's a huge number of people that you and your team have been instrumental in helping. And so kudos for that as well. And I hope you'd be willing to maybe jump on the show again sometime, and you know, we'll do an update and see where things are at in a bit.
Absolutely. I'd be honored.
That'd be great.
I appreciate you guys so much. Thank you for inviting me on and spending time with me. This is very beneficial for me as in all those roles that I play and all the hats that I wear, like I was mentioning before. So I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Appreciate your big heart.